Don't you know what time it is? How crazy of you to be up at this time on a Sunday morning. What a glorious morning it was, with the moon beginning to set and to descend on this clear day of this hope and this gift and this wonder. But one of the strange things about today is that final line in the gospel. It's the actual line that concludes the Gospel of Mark. And the women came out and ran away from the tomb because they were frightened out of their wits. And they said nothing to a soul, for they were afraid. Amen. The end of the story. It's this really odd way for Mark to finish his gospel, which is why later scribes said he must have meant to say something more. You know, it's a bit of a bummer of a text to finish this Easter celebration. This whole sense of them running away, scared, afraid. This whole sense that they're amazed and they were overwhelmed by what they'd seen. And they wanted more. And so scribes added two different conclusions. There's the short ending, and then there's the long ending. So verses 9 and 10, and then there's the long ending of verses 9 to 20. To try and fill out this story, because it seems like this great anticlimax. It seems like there needs to be more to the story, more for us to experience and hear. And yet, in some ways, this is the end of Mark's story, because the gospel won't ever lead us to faith by itself. We have to respond. The story won't lead us satisfied until we answer this question ourselves, because we need to grapple with it. Remember, Mark is writing there in the middle of the 60s in Rome. Persecution has broken out on all sides. The people are beginning to die. Many of the friends of Mark have already been executed. And so in this turbulence, in this trial, people are leaving. People are frightened out of their wits. People aren't saying anything to anyone. And so he's leading us with this question. Well, how will we respond? What will our answer be? How will we address the evidence that has been presented to us? This question has been there right across the pages of Mark. Who is this man? It's this question that's there in the first 8 chapters. The disciples are struggling as they minister around the Sea of Galilee. They're beginning to see the signs and the wonders, the mighty deeds that Jesus has been doing. But they're still confused. They're still caught up with this question of who is this man who's doing all of these things? And then there's that turning point at the end of chapter 8 where finally Peter begins to address it and to say, you are the Messiah, the Christ, the one who is the Son of God. And then they begin their ministry and begin to move towards Jerusalem. But it's only finally at the end of chapter 15 that the centurion is the one who is able to make that profession of faith, who's able to let us into that, what's called the messianic secret. Because every time someone would say that you are the Messiah, Jesus would say, be quiet. Don't say that out loud, because there's only one way that Messiah's ended in the first century, and that was the way of death. And he wasn't ready. It wasn't yet his hour, as St. John will tell us in his gospel. But now he has offered himself and revealed himself of who he truly is. And so it's this pagan, non-believing centurion, this outsider, who's able to make that declaration that truly this is a Son of God. And so the question remains, what will we do with this? How will we respond? How will we open ourselves to this grace and to this gift that God is offering to us? This question that's there and has been there right across the pages. Will we be like these women? Will we run away, amazed and afraid, but unable to respond? Will we be like the young man in chapter 14, who was a follower of Jesus, it seems, but he's scantily clad, and so when the soldiers come to grab him as well, he runs away. They grab hold of the cloak and tear it off his body, and he runs away naked. These are the alternatives that he's been offering to us, these different ways of responding. Or will we be like the ones who do say yes? Will we be like the pagan centurion, a Roman soldier, for goodness sake, in the midst of this Roman persecution of the church? But it's a Roman who's able to say, no, this is truly the Son of God. The tomb becomes for us a sign of this. The tomb becomes a sign of the way that we're meant to respond. That it's only in the emptiness of the tomb that we discover our own place and our own capability of responding to God. Remember back on the second Sunday of Lent, we acted out the story of Abraham being invited to sacrifice his son Isaac. And there was that continued response and reply that Abraham made when God would address him and say, Abraham, Abraham. And Abraham each time replied, how good is your memory? Yes. And in the Hebrew, Hineni, Hineni, here I am. The tomb is kind of that emptiness. The emptiness of the response of Abraham and the response of Mary. The great gift of Mary was that she wasn't full of herself. That she was empty of her own ego, empty of her own sense of who she was, of her self-importance. That she was able simply to say, Hineni, here I am. The resurrection invites us into that same place, that we can only understand and accept the resurrection to the extent that we are as empty as the tomb, that our hearts are not full of ourselves and full of ideas and full of all these doctrines and understandings and tried answers. When I was reflecting on this during the 30-day retreat, that was the thing that really struck me about my heart, that so often I'm just wanting to give those simple, trite answers to complex questions and solutions, trying to offer myself rather than saying, no, it's about God. And to the extent that I offer myself, others will stay empty. But to the extent that I am empty, to the extent that I am able to receive from God and to be changed by God and to have my heart transformed, then I can offer something that's truly worthwhile. That's why Mary becomes that model for us, because in the emptiness of her own heart and the emptiness of her own womb, she was able to conceive the very Son of God. She was able to receive this gift and then share it with us in the world. Otherwise, we stay locked in that exile. We've listened to the story of salvation history tonight. It began in the garden, began with the goodness and the possibilities that offered. But Genesis 1 and 2 tell us the story of the way it's meant to be. But Genesis 3 offers us the reality, the failure, the grasping for the tree of life, the grasping for this fruit of the knowledge of good and evil. Genesis 4 then tells the story of Cain and Abel, who continue to tumble into this experience of sin. And Cain, who stumbles against another sin and this other reality. And in both instances, both Adam and Eve are told to leave, to go away from the garden towards the east. Cain is told also that you must leave, you must be banished, you must go to the east. It's that experience of exile that we tried to move through in that series on Lamentations, that whole experience of being exiled from our true selves, exiled because of sin. And there's always that movement to the east, because all of the scriptures are written as a reflection, not so much of the Exodus event and that moment of triumph, that moment of being freed from sin and slavery, but the reality of the sin that continues to be experienced, and that reality of leaving the promised land, of going from Jerusalem to the east, to Babylon, to that city that will be the sign of the destruction and the consequences of sin. We're always being separated from this call, separated from who we're called to be, and we go to the east. But now, in the light of the resurrection, in the light of this gift, the church understands that the east is no longer this place of slavery, this place of fear. The east becomes the sign of new hope. The east becomes the sign of the resurrection. The east becomes the sign of what our destiny is. And so our churches are oriented towards the east, because it's from the east that is not sin, that is not separation from God, but the east is the sign of hope, the sign of life. If we just go to the final slide, we can celebrate the resurrection of Jesus. We can celebrate this gift because in our emptiness, in our desire to say, "Hineni, here I am," we're able to be returned to the promised land, to that place of being united once again with God. That we're no longer exiled, we're no longer being banished and sent away, but we're invited to return, to Shuva, to come on home, to come to the place of rest, the place of new life, the place that is the gift of our being with God. And so as an Easter people, we gather to celebrate that and to renew our own baptismal promises and to be transformed, to be that place where we can be empty, we can acknowledge our own failure, but to be filled by the goodness of God.